The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Welcome to Discover Extra Edition. Stories from Discover, the magazine of science, that we didn't have time for in our regular monthly podcast. I'm your host, Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Episode number 1 of Discover Extra Edition contains stories from the May 2017 issue of Discover, including Easter Island's Last Native Species, and 10 short profiles of scientists: Albert Einstein, Al Hazen, Chen Sheng Wu, Francis Beaufort, Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin, Raymond Dart, Carl Linnaeus, James Hutton, and Henrietta Lacks. Easter Island's last endemics flirt with extinction. A few native species still survive in remote caves and along cliff sides. On Easter Island, isolated in the vast Pacific Ocean, 10 species of near-microscopic insects are all that remain of the island's native species, at least for now. The endemic insects hide in volcanic caves and eke out an existence in an increasingly imperiled habitat. Tourists who flood this tiny island, called Rapa Nui by the native residents, endanger the tiny bugs' ancestral homes, fragile gardens of moss and ferns. On top of that, hordes of invasive species threaten to crowd them out. Iconic moai, the monolithic stone statues standing some 40 feet tall, immortalized the island, but its most important inhabitants are almost too small to be seen. Rapa Nui's textbook tale of environmental destruction began when humans arrived. Polynesian sailors, carried over the waves in giant canoes, made landfall sometime between AD 800 and 1200. Their new civilization turned tropical forests into boats and building materials. For food, they farmed and fished, and by its 17th century peak, the population had swelled to about 15,000. But just a few thousand people remained when Europeans arrived in 1722. The moai-building islanders caused an ecological shift that devastated species adapted to a specific kind of environment. What was once palm-dominated scrub forest became grassland. The lost species included at least 5 kinds of land birds, sea mammals, insects, and a type of giant palm tree called Paschalococcus disperta, or the Easter Island palm. Ecosystems don't collapse. They shift from one steady state to another. And that's simply what happened here on Rapa Nui, says Jut Win, an ecologist at Northern Arizona University's Merriam Powell Center for Environmental Research. What caused that shift was a very fragile, fire-intolerant ecosystem, and the arrival of humans, timed inauspiciously with an extended drought period. Wynn says that shift strained the existing ecosystem, killing endemic species, and created a much more homogeneous environment. The island now hosts many non-native species, plus sheep, horses, and goats, descendants of the livestock owned by ranchers who worked the island in the early 1900s. Hidden under their feet, however, are some of the last true natives of Rapa Nui. Wynn's childhood dream of visiting Easter Island finally came true in 2008. That year, he launched a baseline study looking at 3 caves. He sampled over a dozen more caves in 2009 and 2011 and turned up 8 new species endemic to the island, bringing the total to 10. Last summer, supported by a Fulbright Fellowship, he expanded his search. The work took him to some of the most remote places on the island in search of fragile habitats where the insects make their last stand. he plumbed the depths of damp caves and rappelled down sheer cliff faces to find the fragmentary patches of moss and ferns where the insects could be hiding. Previous studies showed that many native species once crawled across the island. The remaining insects have likely all retreated to places where conditions reflect the Rapa Nui ecosystem that existed before humans arrived. So far, Wynn has discovered 7 species of springtail, tiny insects whose defining feature is a spring-loaded tail that flips them into the air and away from danger, a built-in ejector seat. He has also found 2 isopod species, popularly known as roly-polies, and 1 species of book louse. And while the results are still tentative, Wynn says his team's search last summer might have doubled the island's known endemic species. Preserving those insects has also taken on new urgency. Roughly 100,000 tourists came through Rapa Nui in 2015, a surfeit of pedestrians for an island totaling only 63 square miles. Even though a national park covers nearly half the island, that hasn't stopped foot traffic. Tourists regularly walk through some of the insects' habitats, completely oblivious to the ramifications of their behavior, Wynn says. Even studying the insects in their natural cave environment presents a delicate balance between scientific enlightenment and harmful intrusion. Invasive species present another threat. American cockroaches, millipedes, and other hitchhikers now pervade the island, threatening to crowd out and eat up the natives. And because of that, says Wynn, we believe that most of the insects on the island are indeed in danger of extinction. He hopes the future may not be as bleak as Rapa Nui's past. Wynn is working with the park system, the community, and the government to increase awareness of the island's unique, invisible treasures. The park has now closed roads to reduce traffic in vital areas. Even small measures, like roping off areas and putting up signs, could have a large impact, Wynn says. Economic incentives make fully protecting the caves difficult, however. The island needs revenue from visitors, and the beautiful vistas and caves filled with indigenous art are a potent lure. Sebastian Yankovic Pacarati, an expert on Rapa Nui's natural heritage and one of Wynn's collaborators, says the island must develop a plan to better protect its natural and cultural treasures before opening the floodgates of tourism. But he is heartened that residents seem willing to play a role in the ongoing protection of their island and its resources. With the combination of newfound support and greater oversight, he is hopeful that these endangered areas can be preserved. The new generations want to pay more attention, not just to conserving and preserving the Moai and the cultural legacy of our ancestors, but we also want to place a major emphasis on nature's heritage and biodiversity, says Pacarati, who serves on the Advisory Council of National Monuments. And the park is now working on a conservation plan to protect and monitor caves in the area with the highest concentration of native species. We hope this initiative can help with the conservation and preservation of the location, and eventually the rest of the island, Pacarati says. Heroes of Science, Albert Einstein, the whole package. A crowd barged past dioramas, glass displays, and wide-eyed security guards in the American Museum of Natural History. Screams rang out as some runners fell and were trampled. Upon arriving at a lecture hall, the mob broke down the door. The date was January 8, 1930, and the New York Museum was showing a film about Albert Einstein and his general theory of relativity. Einstein was not present, but 4,500 mostly ticketless people still showed up for the viewing. Museum officials told them, "No ticket, no show," setting the stage for, in the words of the Chicago Tribune, the first science riot in history. Such was Einstein's popularity. As a publicist might say, he was the whole package, distinctive look, untamed hair, rumpled sweater, witty personality, his quips, such as God not playing dice, would live on, and major scientific cred, his papers upended physics. Time magazine named him Person of the Century. Einstein remains the last and perhaps only physicist ever to become a household name, says James Overduin, a theoretical physicist at Towson University in Maryland. Born in Ulm, Germany, in 1879, Einstein was a precocious child. As a teenager, he wrote a paper on magnetic fields. Einstein never actually failed math, contrary to popular lore. He married twice, the second time to his first cousin, Elsa Lowenthal. The marriage lasted until her death in 1936. As a scientist, Einstein's watershed year was 1905, when he was working as a clerk in the Swiss Patent Office, having failed to attain an academic position after earning his doctorate. That year, he published his four most important papers. One of them described the relationship between matter and energy, neatly summarized, E equals mc squared. Other papers that year were on Brownian motion, suggesting the existence of molecules and atoms, and the photoelectric effect, showing that light is made of particles later called photons. His fourth paper, about special relativity, explained that space and time are interwoven, a shocking idea now considered a foundational principle of astronomy. Einstein expanded on relativity in 1916 with his theory of gravitation, general relativity. It holds that anything with mass distorts the fabric of space and time, just as a bowling ball placed on a bed causes the mattress to sag. During a solar eclipse in 1919, astronomers showed that the sun's mass did indeed bend the path of starlight. The temporary darkness around the sun enabled astronomers to chronicle the bending. The validation made Einstein a superstar. 2 years later, Einstein won the Nobel Prize in Physics, not for general relativity, but for his discovery of the photoelectric effect. By this time, the 42-year-old physicist had made most of his major contributions to science. In 1933, Einstein accepted a professorship at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, where for years he tried, unsuccessfully, to unify the laws of physics. He became a U.S. citizen in 1940, and his fame grew as a public intellectual, civil rights supporter, and pacifist. Many consider Einstein's theory of general relativity to be his crowning achievement. The theory predicted both black holes and gravitational waves, and just last year, physicists measured the waves created by the collision of two black holes over a billion light years away. During their epic journey across the cosmos, the ripples played with space and time like a funhouse mirror contorting faces. General relativity also is the bedrock of gravitational lensing, which uses the gravity of stars and galaxies as a giant magnifying glass to zoom in on farther cosmic objects. Astronomers may soon take advantage of such physics to see geographic details of worlds light years away. Einstein, who died of heart failure in 1955, would have applauded such bold imaginative thinking. His greatest insights came not from careful experimental analysis, but simply considering what would happen under certain circumstances, and letting his mind play with the possibilities. "I am enough of an artist to draw freely upon my imagination," he said in a Saturday Evening Post interview. "Knowledge is limited. Imagination encircles the world." Heroes of Science. Al Hazen, Method Man. Observe, hypothesize, experiment, revise, repeat. The scientific method is the foundation upon which researchers build. The man who laid the groundwork for it, however, is all but forgotten in the West. Born in the mid-10th century in what is now Iraq, Ibn al-Haytham, known to English speakers as Al-Hazen, was a man of endless curiosity. At a time when the Arabic-speaking world was the epicenter of scientific inquiry, Alhazen was one of its brightest stars. He wrote more than 100 books on physics, mathematics, and astronomy, among other fields, and is believed to be the first to explain how our brains create the illusion of the moon appearing larger near the horizon. His pioneering work on optics inspired the likes of Roger Bacon and Johannes Kepler centuries later. But Alhazen's creation of the scientific method is his most far-reaching achievement. Known for developing theories based on experimentation and data collection rather than abstract thought, Alhazen stressed the need to test results, especially those considered canon, as he wrote in his Doubts Against Ptolemy. Quote, "A person who studies scientific books with a view of knowing the real facts ought to turn himself into an opponent of everything that he studies. He should thoroughly assess its main as well as its margin parts, and oppose it from every point of view and in all its aspects. If he takes this course, the real facts will be revealed to him." End quote. Alhazen's advice can be seen in action today around the world, from middle school science fairs to the Large Hadron Collider. Chen Xing Wu, First Lady of Physics. Chen Xing Wu's path to the highest levels of science began in coastal China's Jiangsu province. She arrived in the U.S. in 1936 to pursue a doctorate at the University of California, Berkeley. While there, her experiments with X-ray emissions and xenon gas became important contributions to the Manhattan Project. But it was her work a few years later at Columbia University that would earn her a place in the physics pantheon. Wu was the first to verify, and later refine, Enrico Fermi's theory of radioactive beta decay, which describes how some unstable atoms emit radiation when transforming into more stable atoms. In 1956, other researchers asked Wu to help them prove their hypothesis about a breakdown of the law of parity. The law states that objects and their mirror images should behave the same way, only reversed, like a right and left hand. Wu's complex experiments confirmed their hypothesis. The team won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1957, but never acknowledged Wu's contribution. The lack of credit didn't hold Wu back. She went on to become the first woman president of the American Physical Society and a National Medal of Science recipient. She enjoyed a long career as a distinguished professor and great acclaim within her field, where she was known as the First Lady of Physics. At a memorials conference in her honor in 1997, Nobel laureate Leon Lederman spoke for many when he recalled her exacting standards during their collaboration decades earlier. "The week of agony I endured some 40 years ago at the hands of my esteemed colleague C.S. Wu taught me a lesson about what it means to be a great scientist. That is, that validity of your results must have the highest priority." Heroes of Science, Francis Beaufort, Charting a Course for Good. When he was barely a teenager in the 1780s, Francis Beaufort went to sea in the British Royal Navy. On his first voyage to China, the ship foundered because of inaccurate navigational charts. Beaufort and other crew members spent 5 days on the open water before being rescued. The harrowing experience set him on his life's course. When he was a midshipman, Beaufort began making weather reports every 2 hours rather than the standard 12 to 24-hour span. By the time he was in command, he kept a detailed weather journal as well, and he had devised a system of alphanumeric notations about weather conditions that became standard throughout the Navy. You may have heard of the Beaufort scale, which evolved out of his notation system, and classifies wind force. Though Beaufort developed the scale for winds at sea, it was later modified to include overland winds as well. What you may not know are Beaufort's other contributions to science. When he was appointed hydrographer to the Admiralty in 1829, he was determined to map all uncharted waters. Over the next 26 years, he produced nearly 1,500 meticulously detailed charts, some of which are still, like his notation system, in use today. He also began publishing mariner notices and timetables, transforming the hydrographer's office from obscurity into a cutting-edge institution. Oh, and one more science assist. In 1831, as Captain Robert Fitzroy prepared to survey the coast of South America, he asked Beaufort to find someone well-educated, some scientific person, to accompany the expedition. Fitzroy's ship was the HMS Beagle. Beaufort recommended Charles Darwin. Isaac Newton, the man who defined science on a bet. Isaac Newton was born on Christmas Day, 1642. Never the humble sort, he would have found the date apt. The gift to humanity and science had arrived. A sickly infant, his mere survival was an achievement. Just 23 years later, with his alma mater Cambridge University and much of England closed due to plague, Newton discovered the laws that now bear his name. He had to invent a new kind of math along the way, calculus. The introverted English scholar held off on publishing those findings for decades, though, and it took the Herculean efforts of friend and comet discoverer Edmund Halley to get Newton to publish. The only reason Halley knew of Newton's work? A bet the former had made with other scientists on the nature of planetary orbits. When Halley mentioned the orbital problem to him, Newton shocked his friend by giving the answer immediately, having long ago worked it out. Halley persuaded Newton to publish his calculations, and the results were the Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, or just the Principia, in 1687. Not only did it describe for the first time how the planets moved through space and how projectiles on Earth traveled through the air, the Principia showed that the same fundamental force, gravity, governs both. Newton united the heavens and the Earth with his laws. Thanks to him, scientists believed they had a chance of unlocking the universe's secrets. Newton's academic devotion was absolute. His sometime assistant, Humphrey Newton, no relation, wrote, "I never knew him to take any recreation. He would only really leave his room to give lectures, even to empty rooms. Oft-times he did in a manner, for want of hearers, read to the walls," Humphrey wrote in 1727. Newton never went halfway on anything. It would take too long to list his other scientific achievements, but the greatest hits might include his groundbreaking work on light and color, his development and refinement of reflecting telescopes, which now bear his name, and other fundamental work in math and heat. He also dabbled in biblical prophecies, predicting the world's end in AD 2060, practicing alchemy, and spent years trying and failing to produce the fabled philosopher's stone. Alas, even Newton's genius couldn't create the impossible. In 1692, this rare failure, along with the unraveling of one of his few close friendships, and possibly mercury poisoning from his alchemical experiments, resulted in what we'd now call a prolonged nervous breakdown. Newton's science-producing days were over, for reasons known only to him, though he would remain influential in the field. So how did Newton pass his remaining three decades? Remarkably, by modernizing England's economy and catching criminals. After languishing on a professor's salary at Cambridge University for decades, in 1696, Newton received a cushy royal appointment to be Warden of the Mint in London. It was meant as an easy job with a nice paycheck. "It has not been too much business to require more attendance than you may spare," his friend Charles Montagu wrote after landing him the job. But Newton, focused as ever, threw himself into it. After a promotion to Master of the Mint, he oversaw the recoinage of English currency, advised on economics, established the gold standard, and replaced all the country's metal currency with improved ridged coins, still in use today, which made it harder to shave off bits of the precious metals. He also focused his attention on counterfeiters, searching them out as zealously as he sought answers from the heavens. Newton established information networks among London's shadiest spots, even going undercover to do so. Counterfeiting was considered high treason, punishable by death, and Newton relished witnessing his target's executions. Newton was known by his peers as an unpleasant person. He had few close friends and never married. Astronomer Royal John Flamsteed called him insidious, ambitious, and excessively covetous of praise, and impatient of contradiction. The man could nurse grudges for years, even after his foes died. He famously feuded with German scientist Gottfried Leibniz, mainly over who invented calculus first, creating a schism in European mathematics that lasted over a century. Newton also made it his life's work to torment English scientist Robert Hooke, destroying the legacy of a man once considered London's Leonardo da Vinci. How fitting that the unit of force is named after stubborn, persistent, amazing Newton, himself a force of nature. Charles Darwin, delivering the evolutionary gospel. Charles Darwin would not have been anyone's first guess for a revolutionary scientist. As a young man, his main interests were collecting beetles and studying geology in the countryside, occasionally skipping out on his classes at the University of Edinburgh Medical School to do so. It was a chance invitation in 1831 to join a journey around the world that would make Darwin, who had once studied to become a country parson, the father of evolutionary biology. Aboard the HMS Beagle, between bouts of seasickness, Darwin spent his five-year trip studying and documenting geological formations and myriad habitats throughout much of the southern hemisphere, as well as the flora and fauna they contained. Darwin's observations pushed him to a disturbing realization. The Victorian-era theories of animal origins were all wrong. Most people in Darwin's time still adhered to creationism, the idea that a divine being was responsible for the diversity of life we find on Earth. Darwin's observations implied a completely different process. He noticed small differences between members of the same species that seemed to depend upon where they lived. The finches of the Galapagos are the best-known example. From island to island, finches of the same species possessed differently shaped beaks, each adapted to the unique sources of food available on each island. This suggested not only that species could change, already a divisive concept back then, but also that the changes were driven purely by environmental factors instead of divine intervention. Today we call this natural selection. When Darwin returned, he was hesitant to publish his nascent ideas and open them up to criticism, as he felt that his theory of evolution was still insubstantial. Instead, he threw himself into studying the samples from his voyage and writing an account of his travels. Through his industrious efforts, Darwin built a reputation as a capable scientist, publishing works on geology as well as studies of coral reefs and barnacles, still considered definitive today. Darwin also married his first cousin, Emma Wedgwood, during this time. They had 10 children, and by all accounts, Darwin was an engaged and loving father, encouraging his children's interests and taking time to play with them. This was a level of attention uncommon among fathers at that time, to say nothing of eminent scientists. Through it all, the theory of evolution was never far from his mind, and the various areas of research he pursued only strengthened his convictions. Darwin slowly amassed overwhelming evidence in favor of evolution in the 20 years after his voyage. All of his observations and musings eventually coalesced into the tour de force that was On the Origin of Species, published in 1859 when Darwin was 50 years old. The 500-page book sold out immediately, and Darwin would go on to produce 6 editions, each time adding to and refining his arguments. In non-technical language, the book laid out a simple argument for how the wide array of Earth species came to be. It was based on 2 ideas, that species can change gradually over time, and that all species face difficulties brought on by their surroundings. From these basic observations, it stands to reason that those species best adapted to their environments will survive, and those that fall short will die out. Though Darwin's theory was logically sound and backed up by reams of evidence, his ideas faced sharp criticisms from adherents of creationism and the religious establishment around the world, just as he had feared. Although it wouldn't become widely accepted until the 1930s, Darwin's theory of natural selection and his ideas on evolution have survived largely intact. I can't emphasize enough how revolutionary Darwin's theory was, and how much it changed people's views in so short a time, says Jerry Coyne, professor emeritus in the Department of Ecology and Evolution at the University of Chicago. On the Origin of Species is absolutely thorough and meticulously documented, and anticipated virtually all the counterarguments. There's nothing you can really say to go after the important aspects of Darwin's theory. Raymond Dart, Getting to the Root of It. In 1924, scientific consensus held that humans had evolved somewhere in Eurasia. After all, human-like fossils had been found from Germany's Neander Valley to the Indonesian island of Java. Then an Australian anatomist working in South Africa received a package. The delivery was expected. Its contents were not. The box was supposed to contain a fossilized partial baboon skull from a limestone quarry in the country's heartland. Raymond Dart had planned to add it to a museum collection. To Dart's surprise, the skull in the box belonged to a child. Not a human child, but also not a baboon. The specimen was large-brained. Because the spinal cord entered the skull at the bottom rather than at the back, as it does for chimps, Dart believed the individual had walked upright, until then considered an exclusively human trait. He called the skull Australopithecus africanus and argued that it showed we evolved in Africa. Science, its center of authority then firmly in Western Europe, scoffed. But South African paleontologist Robert Broom and Dart began exploring the country's numerous cave systems. They turned up more fossils, far older than any from Eurasia. Even as Dart's theory of our ancestral African homeland was vindicated, a series of discoveries in eastern Africa, beginning in 1959, suggested that was where our ancestors had evolved. Over the past 2 decades, however, South Africa has reemerged as the potential root of our family tree, with additional finds, some older than eastern Africa's famous Lucy. Paleoanthropologists still disagree on where our ancestors took their first bipedal steps. But the debate, thanks to Dart, is over which part of Africa we should call home. Carl Linnaeus. Say his names. It started in Sweden, a functional, user-friendly innovation that took over the world, bringing order to chaos. No, not an IKEA closet organizer. We're talking about the binomial nomenclature system, which has given us clarity and a common language devised by Carl Linnaeus. Linnaeus, born in southern Sweden in 1707, was an intensely practical man, according to Sandra Knapp, a botanist and taxonomist at the Natural History Museum in London. He lived at a time when formal scientific training was scant, and there was no system for referring to living things. Plants and animals had common names, which varied from one location and language to the next, and scientific phrase names, cumbersome Latin descriptions that could run several paragraphs. The 18th century was also a time when European explorers were fanning out across the globe, finding ever more plants and animals new to science. there got to be more and more things that needed to be described, and the names were becoming more and more complex, says Knapp. Linnaeus, a botanist with a talent for noticing details, first used what he called trivial names in the margins of his 1753 book, Species Plantarum. He intended the simple Latin two-word construction for each plant as a kind of shorthand, an easy way to remember what it was. It reflected the adjective-noun structure in languages all over the world, Knapp says of the trivial names, which today we know as genus and species. The names moved quickly from the margins of a single book to the center of botany, and then all of biology. Linnaeus started a revolution, but it was an unintentional one. Today we regard Linnaeus as the father of taxonomy, which is used to sort the entire living world into evolutionary hierarchies, or family trees. But the systematic Swede was mostly interested in naming things rather than ordering them, an emphasis that arrived the next century with Charles Darwin. As evolution became better understood and, more recently, genetic analysis changed how we classify and organize living things, many of Linnaeus's other ideas have been supplanted. But his naming system, so simple and adaptable, remains. It doesn't matter to the tree in the forest if it has a name, Knapp says, but by giving it a name, we can discuss it. Linnaeus gave us a system so we could talk about the natural world. James Hutton, Unconformist Rockstar. Born in Edinburgh at the height of the Enlightenment, James Hutton was a gifted observer. With that skill, he would formulate the first theories of deep time, and of how our planet's surface constantly recycles itself, ideas considered heretical in his day. Hutton's work became the basis of modern geology, inspired Charles Darwin, and prefigured plate tectonics, volcanology, geobiology, and the Gaia hypothesis, a late 20th century view of the planet as a single self-regulating organism. His keen eyes also steered him away early on from a different path. After attending medical school in the 1740s, Hutton opted to become a gentleman farmer. He traveled through much of Britain, learning the latest agricultural techniques. But the landscapes themselves increasingly drew his attention. He became obsessed with unconformities in the rocks, where strata are distorted, rumpled, or jumbled in composition, some layers of rock thrusting near vertically into those above or below. Earth, Hutton theorized, was not a static thing, but a dynamic world of constant reinvention. Continents built up and then wore down, the cycle repeating over millions or even billions of years. Hutton lived at a time when even learned natural philosophers, the word scientist did not yet exist, believed Earth was a mere 6,000 years old. When he finally published Theory of the Earth in 1788, he endured vituperative criticism. The key word here is endured. Despite the initial negative reaction, and a few decades of obscurity after his death, Hutton's theory eventually became mainstream, the bedrock upon which modern earth sciences sit. Henrietta Lacks, Woman, Cell Line, Symbol. More than 65 years after her death, Henrietta Lacks' contributions to science are a cause célèbre. HBO planned to air a movie about her life in April. High-profile lectures and conferences now bear her name. When Lacks died at 31, however, a wife, a mother of five, and an impoverished black tobacco farmer struck down by cervical cancer, she was virtually unknown. Tissues from the malignancy were collected without the knowledge or consent of Lacks or her family and used to create the first human-derived cell lines. HeLa, as the cell lines are known, have proven invaluable for cancer research. They have been the basis of tens of thousands of experiments. But researchers barely tried to protect Lacks's identity, treating her cells as no different from a sample collected from a lab rat. When writer Rebecca Skloot's 2010 bestseller, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, brought her story into the public spotlight, it spurred an outcry. Little changed, however. In 2013, researchers published the HeLa genome, with personal information pertaining to both Lacks and her family, online with her identity. The incident led the National Institutes of Health to create a review process that gave Lacks' descendants a voice in approving future HeLa research. The arrangement represents a new era in the handling of human genetic material. There are other Henriettas out there, individuals whose genetic information has been used in research without consent. It's logistically impossible to track down these unwitting participants or their descendants. Instead, they remain the true unsung heroes of science. Henrietta Lacks' greatest legacy is to give them a face, that we be reminded of our debt to them. That wraps up this episode of Discover Extra Edition. I hope you've enjoyed it and will tune in to another podcast soon. Until then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.